Okay, so picture this. You've got a scenario that plays out at major international airports way more often than anyone in the industry actually wants to admit.
Oh, yeah, constantly.
Right. So you have this massive wide-body commercial airliner sitting at the gate. And I mean, we are talking about a machine that represents hundreds of millions of dollars of cutting-edge aerospace engineering.
Absolutely. The peak of human engineering, really.
Exactly. The fuel tanks are topped off. The cargo is loaded. The flight crew has done all their pre-flight checklists. I mean, the passengers are literally sitting in their seats, ready to go.
But the plane isn't moving.
No, it is not moving. It is in what they call an AOG state aircraft on ground.
Yeah.
And here's the kicker. It's not grounded because an engine blew out or, the landing gear
Right,
collapsed.
or a massive software failure.
Nope. It's grounded and bleeding tens of thousands of dollars by the minute, by the way, because of a discrepancy on a piece of paper. A piece of paper roughly the size of a standard invoice.
It's just wild to think about.
It really is. Specifically, we're talking about this incredibly nuanced, hyper-regulated document known as the FAA Form 8130-3.
Yeah, the 8133, it's really the ultimate paradox of modern aviation logistics when you think about it.
How so?
Well, you have this massive physical asset, right? Engineered to withstand immense aerodynamic stress, lightning strikes, extreme temperatures, and it's entirely paralyzed by a missing signature.
Just a missing signature.
Exactly. I mean, to anyone outside the aerospace supply chain, it sounds like this ridiculous administrative failure,
Right.
just bureaucracy run amok.
Right, like somebody just forgot to stamp a form in triplicate.
Exactly. But when you actually understand the regulatory framework, which is what we're going to get into, you realize that piece of paper is literally the only thing separating a safe aircraft from an uninsurable liability.
And that distinction is exactly what we are tearing into today on this deep dive.
It's a fascinating topic.
It really is. So we are pulling our insights from this highly detailed technical breakdown that was published on March 31st, 2026 in Aviation Maintenance Magazine.
Right, the article called Examining 8133 Tags.
That's the one. So the mission for this deep dive for you listening right now is to decode this hyper-specific, high-stakes ecosystem.
We're basically going to map out how global supply chains, international law, and strict engineering tolerances all violently collide on this single sheet of paper.
A single split signature sheet of paper, to be exact. And the goal is that you never look at aviation logistics the same way again.
Yeah, it requires a pretty fundamental shift in how we view physical objects.
Tell me about that, because there's a joke in the source material, right?
Oh yeah, there's this old, somewhat grim joke among maintenance crews that the paperwork weighs more than the part, and you literally cannot install the part until the paperwork outweighs it.
That's hilarious, but it's also kind of terrifying.
It is, because that hyperbole actually masks a profound reality. The source text makes it very clear that over the past 30 years, this entire regulatory philosophy has hardened significantly.
Pardon in what way?
Well, documentation is no longer just an accessory to the hardware. It's not just a receipt. It has become the primary, undeniable evidence of airworthiness.
Okay, let's unpack this because I think a lot of professionals who are adjacent to this field, like maybe people in tech or automotive logistics, they might look at this and think the aviation sector is just trapped in a bureaucratic dark
Well,
age.
they absolutely think that.
I mean, it's like buying a priceless vintage watch, right? If you lose the certificate of authenticity, the watch still ticks perfectly. It still tells time.
Yeah, but its value and legal standing plummet to zero.
Exactly. But why has it gotten so strict in aviation? I mean, surely a physical inspection can prove a part is good. We have amazing tech now.
We do.
We have non-destructive testing. We have ultrasound, eddy current inspections. We have laser micrometers that can measure tolerances down to the micron.
All true.
So if I have a high-pressure turbine blade in my hand and it passes every conceivable diagnostic test with flying colors, why is an incomplete paper trail an automatic death sentence for that component?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's because your diagnostics only tell you the physical state of the component at the exact moment you are measuring it.
Okay.
They cannot definitively prove the history of the environment it was subjected to. The aviation industry doesn't just evaluate physical condition, it evaluates historical condition.
Historical conditions. So you're talking about the chain of custody.
Precisely. Let's say your turbine blade passes that laser micrometer test. That's great. It's dimensionally perfect.
Awesome. Put it in the engine.
Not so fast. What if 3 years ago, That blade sat in a non-climate controlled warehouse in high humidity.
Oh, I see.
And maybe a microscopic layer of oxidation formed internally before some warehouse worker just sealed it back in a box.
Wrong.
Or what if it was dropped from a forklift?
Right, and it suffered some tiny subsurface stress fracture that your specific ultrasound calibration just happened to miss?
Exactly. You don't know the parameters of the trauma you're supposed to be looking for.
Mm-hmm. That makes total sense. So the physical inspection is fundamentally incomplete because you don't know what it went through.
Right. If you use a software analogy, think of the 8133-TREG like a cryptographic hash for a downloaded file.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, you can run the executable software, and it might seem to work perfectly fine for a while.
But without that matching checksum, you have zero guarantee that malicious code wasn't injected somewhere along the line.
Exactly. And in aviation, the malicious code is metallurgical fatigue or improper heat treatment or, you know, unapproved raw materials used during manufacturing.
Right. So the 80133F3 tag provides that cryptographic guarantee.
Yes. It proves that the unbroken chain of custody, literally from the moment the raw titanium was forged to the moment it arrived at your hangar, remained perfectly sterile and compliant.
Wow. That fundamentally changes the definition of the word airworthy.
It really does.
It's not just a physical state. It's a combined physical and legal state.
It is entirely bifurcated. To be airworthy under FAA regulations, a part actually has to meet two distinct criteria.
Okay, what are they?
First, it must conform to its approved type design. That's the engineering side. It has to match the blueprints.
Right.
Second, it must be in a condition for safe operation. That's the physical side. So you can have a part that is physically flawless.
But if you lose the paperwork proving it conforms to the original FAA-approved engineering data, it legally ceases to be airworthy.
Exactly. It becomes what the industry calls a ghost part.
A ghost part? That sounds so ominous.
Yeah, it is, especially for the accountants.
I can imagine that has to lead to a staggering amount of stranded capital.
Oh, millions and millions of dollars.
Like, you could walk into an MRO, a maintenance, repair, and overhaul facility, and just see shelves lined with perfectly good parts, right?
Oh, absolutely. You'll see actuators, incredible expensive avionics displays, hydraulic pumps, all sitting there as heavy paperweights.
Just because the traceability went cold?
Right. They can't be installed on an aircraft, and they can't be sold. They are completely quarantined.
That is wild.
So to understand how this strict chain of custody is actually enforced, we have to look at the document itself.
Right. Let's look at the anatomy of the form, because it's not just a standard checklist, is it?
No, not at all. The FAA Form 8130-3 is not a simple top-to-bottom questionnaire. The actual layout of the page, the geography of the form, essentially dictates its legal application.
The geography, I love that term.
Yeah, the source article actually spends a significant amount of time breaking down the distinction between the left side of the form and the right side.
Okay, let's tackle the left side signature first, because the text makes it very clear that this side is highly restrictive.
Very restrictive.
The left side, which encompasses blocks 13A through 13E, is strictly reserved for airworthiness approvals for new parts.
Yes, but not just any newly manufactured piece of metal. That's the key.
Right. It must be a new part produced under an FAA production approval.
That is the critical filter. It all comes back to Title 14 of the Code of Federal Regulations.
Good old Title 14.
Specifically Part 21, which governs certification procedures for products and articles. If an aerospace manufacturer wants to build a new aircraft or replacement parts for that aircraft in the U.S., they must operate under an FAA production approval.
Like a production certificate or a PC.
Exactly.
So if we look at a massive domestic giant like Boeing, they hold this huge overarching production certificate from the FAA.
Right.
So when a brand new replacement flap track comes off the Boeing assembly line, it is essentially born under the umbrella of that FAA Part 21 approval.
Exactly. And because it was manufactured under that specific, heavily audited system, Boeing, as their production approval holder, has the legal authority to issue an 8133 tag for that new part.
And when they do that, their authorized personnel sign the left side of that form.
Right on the left side, block 13.
But wait, let's dig into the mechanics of that signature, because the liability here seems astronomical.
It is immense.
When that quality assurance manager signs block 13, what exactly are they legally declaring? I mean, to the federal government and to whoever buys the part downstream?
They are making a binding legal declaration that the article conforms to the approved design data and that it is in a condition for safe operation at the exact moment of release.
I have to push back on the logistics of that, though.
Okay, go for it.
Does the FAA actually have federal inspectors stationed at the end of every single aerospace assembly line in the country? Like,
yeah.
Guys in suits just stamping these forms all day as parts roll off?
No, that's a common misconception.
Because the sheer volume of parts required to sustain the global fleet makes that sound totally impossible.
You're right. It is impossible. The FAA absolutely does not have the manpower to inspect every rivet or every turbine blade.
So how does it work?
They operate on a system of audited delegation. When the FAA grants that production certificate to the manufacturer, they are rigorously auditing the manufacturer's own internal quality assurance system.
Oh, I see. So they are essentially deputizing the company's internal QA department.
Exactly. The trust isn't placed in the individual part itself on a one-by-one basis.
The trust is placed in the systemic process that created the part.
Exactly. So the signature on the left side of the 8133 is essentially the manufacturer stating, "Our FAA-approved system functioned flawlessly, and this part is the physical proof."
Wow. So it is an immense transfer of liability.
Huge. Because if that flap track fails in flight 6 months later, and investigators trace the serial number back to that specific 8133 tag, the manufacturer cannot claim ignorance.
Right. They can't say, "Oh, well, a machine must have calibrated weirdly that day."
No. That left side signature is the definitive legal record of who vouched for the component's birth into the aviation ecosystem.
Okay, so the left side of the form is essentially the birth certificate.
That's a great way to put it.
And it is entirely dependent on the part being born within the jurisdiction of an FAA production approval, which creates a very clean, closed-loop system for domestic manufacturers in the U.S.
Clean and closed, yes.
But as the source text highlights, the aviation industry isn't domestic. It's aggressively global.
Highly global. Parts cross borders every single minute of every single day.
Right. And this strict jurisdictional boundary creates what the article identifies as a massive regulatory anomaly when we start looking at European aircraft.
Yes. The Airbus anomaly.
The Airbus anomaly. This sounds like a sci-fi thriller.
It kind of plays out like a bureaucratic thriller in the hangars, honestly.
Yeah.
This is where the rigidity of the paperwork meets the really messy reality of international trade.
Okay, let's lay out the conflict for you listening. You have thousands of Airbus aircraft flying globally, right?
Right. Very common aircraft.
And Airbus is a European conglomerate. Therefore, their aircraft and the replacement parts they build are not produced under an American FAA production certificate.
No, they are not. They are produced under a European Production Organization authorization, or a POA.
A POA. And that's overseen by EASA, the European Union Aviation Safety Agency.
Correct. Which means Airbus, operating under that European POA, is legally authorized to issue the European equivalent of the documentation.
Which is the EAS Form 1.
Exactly. EASA Form 1.
But they are not authorized to issue an FAA Form 8130-3 for new parts.
They absolutely cannot. They lack the fundamental legal prerequisite, which is an FAA production approval.
Okay, so this is where the source material raises a massive, glaring red flag for anyone working in aviation logistics.
It's a trap a lot of newer people fall into.
Right. So imagine you are an auditor or maybe a receiving inspector at a maintenance facility in, say, Texas.
Okay.
You open a box, and inside is a brand new, purely European Airbus component, straight from the factory in Toulouse.
Right.
And attached to that component is an FAA Form 8130-3 with a signature on the left side. What is your immediate reaction?
You stop everything. You immediately quarantine the
Really? Just shut it down.
Yes. The article is very explicit about this scenario. An FAA designee cannot blindly sign an 8130-3 tag just because a customer asks for it.
Even if the customer is demanding it for their inventory system.
Especially then. The designee has to perform basically investigative detective work.
Yeah.
They must ask the fundamental jurisdictional question.
Which is there any FAA production approval associated with the specific component?
Exactly. And if it's a pure Airbus part coming straight from the European assembly line, the answer is definitively no.
And if the answer is no, what happens?
The component is completely fundamentally ineligible for a new part 8133-3. Full stop.
Wow. So if you see one on a purely European part, something is very wrong.
If you see one, you are looking at a critical documentation error, a profound misunderstanding of international aviation law, or potentially A fraudulent document.
Fraudulent. That's a scary word in aviation.
It is the scariest word.
I really want to emphasize the logistical nightmare this creates for supply chain managers, though. Because think about airlines. You have massive airlines operating mixed fleets.
Almost all the majors do. They fly Boeing 777s. They fly Airbus A350s.
Right. So they have these vast warehouses holding tens of thousands of spare parts. And because of this jurisdictional boundary, they have to run completely segregated, parallel paperwork streams.
Yes. It's incredibly complex.
You might have two different hydraulic valves sitting on a shelf. They look remarkably similar. Maybe they even do essentially the same job.
But one belongs to a Boeing, one to an Airbus.
Exactly. One must be tracked, stored, and audited entirely under the EASA Form 1 ecosystem, and the other strictly under the FAA 8133 ecosystem.
The friction that introduces into inventory management is staggering. It really is.
I bet.
It requires an incredibly sophisticated enterprise resource planning system just to ensure you don't accidentally mix the regulatory streams.
Because what happens if you do mix them?
Well, installing an ES-tagged part on an aircraft that strictly requires an FAA-tagged part, even if the parts are physically identical and perfectly safe, is a major regulatory violation.
It can ground the aircraft.
It will ground the aircraft the second an auditor catches it.
That is insane. But surely the system isn't completely impenetrable.
What do you mean?
Well, if a purely European part can't get an FAA tag, it implies American manufacturers are just totally locked out of supplying the Airbus aftermarket.
Oh, I see.
Like, if I run a super advanced aerospace manufacturing facility in Ohio, and I figure out how to build a better, cheaper replacement widget for an Airbus A320, am I just legally barred from participating in that market because I'm on the wrong side of the Atlantic Ocean?
No. The market is way too valuable for that to be the case.
Okay, good.
The regulatory agencies recognize the absolute need for a globalized supply chain. However, because the jurisdictional boundary we just talked about is so rigid, the FAA had to engineer very specific legal bridges.
Legal bridges to allow American companies to participate in the European aftermarket.
Exactly.
And the source outlines the two primary American workarounds that bypass this whole Airbus anomaly.
Right, the PMA and the TSOA.
Yes. Here's where it gets really interesting. These are the exceptions that allow a part intended for a European aircraft to legally carry an American 8133 tag.
And it's all about how they are approved.
Let's break down the mechanics of each, starting with the PMA. What exactly is that?
So PMA stands for Parts Manufacturer Approval. This is a very specific type of FAA production approval. It's granted to a manufacturer to produce replacement or modification parts. Crucially, these parts are intended for installation on a type certificated product like our hypothetical Airbus A320.
Now, the company holding this PMA, the ones making a part in Ohio, they don't have to be affiliated with Airbus at all, do they?
Not necessarily, no. You could have a completely independent American engineering firm. They look at an Airbus component, they realize they can manufacture it more efficiently or make it more durable.
Right.
And they apply for an FAA PMA. Mm-hmm. But to get it, they have to prove to the FAA, usually through exhaustive test and computation data, that their specific replacement part is at least equal to or better than the original design.
So they can't just copy it, they have to prove it works.
Yes. And they have to prove that they have a quality system capable of producing it consistently over time.
So they essentially create their own parallel FAA-approved origin story for that specific part.
Exactly. That's one path. Or the PMA holder might actually be a company that already acts as a direct supplier to Airbus.
Wait, how does that work?
So imagine a company that makes the parts for the new planes in Europe under Airbus's authority. But they specifically want an FAA PMA so they can sell replacement parts directly to American airlines in the aftermarket.
Ah, so they want to cut out the middleman.
Right. Rather than forcing Delta or United to buy everything through Airbus in Europe, the supplier sells direct.
Okay, so in either scenario, whether it's an independent competitor or an existing supplier, because that specific American facility went through the grueling process of securing an official FAA parts manufacturer approval, they now hold an FAA production approval.
Yes. And because they hold that approval, the jurisdictional requirement is satisfied.
The magic prerequisite.
Exactly. When that new PMA part rolls off their assembly line in Ohio, they are legally authorized to issue the FAA form 8133. Signed proudly on the left side.
Boom. American tag for a European plane.
You got it. Okay, that covers the PMA workaround. What about the second bridge, the TSOA? So TSOA stands for Technical Standard Order Authorization. While a PMA is usually an approval to build a specific replacement part for a specific aircraft, a TSOA is slightly different.
How so?
The FAA publishes these technical standard orders, which are basically minimum performance standards for specified materials, parts, or appliances.
Okay, like what kind of parts?
Think of things that are universal across many planes. Seat belts, life rafts, or highly standardized avionics transponders.
Ah, okay. So it's a generic standard rather than a reverse-engineered specific part.
Right. So an American company designs, say, a transponder that meets the rigorous standards of the applicable FAA TSO. The FAA grants them the authorization to manufacture it.
And now they have an FAA production approval.
Exactly. Now, that transponder might be entirely intended for installation on a huge fleet of Airbus aircraft.
Right.
But because the American manufacturer holds the TSOA, which again is an FAA production approval, they can issue the A133 tag for that new transponder.
Got it. Now, the text mentions a critical regulatory detail here regarding who physically signs the tag in these workaround scenarios.
Right. The actual signature authority.
For both the PMA and the TSOA, the 8133 can be issued directly by the manufacturer using a specific regulation. I think it's 14 CFR 21.1370.
Yes, that regulation grants them direct ship authority.
Direct ship authority. Alternatively, it can be issued by an FAA employee or a designated representative.
True. But regardless of who holds the pen and signs it, the legal burden remains exactly the same.
What's the burden?
When they put ink on the left side of that form, they must verify two absolute conditions. First, that the component was undeniably produced under the scope of that specific FAA production approval.
Okay, that makes sense. Check the serial numbers, check the batch.
Right. And second, they must verify that from the moment it left the QA system to the moment the tag is issued, it has not suffered any damage or degradation.
Which brings us right back to our earlier discussion about metallurgical fatigue and invisible hazards.
Exactly. The signatory is legally guaranteeing that the part hasn't been dropped on the factory floor, hasn't been thermally shocked, hasn't been exposed to corrosive chemicals in transit across the warehouse.
They are guaranteeing that the physical reality of the part perfectly matches the approved engineering data.
Yes. And if they cannot guarantee that unbroken chain, even if they suspect a forklift bumped the pallet, they cannot sign the tag.
It's all about trust and verification.
100%.
Okay, so we've covered the abstract concepts. We've talked about POAs, PMAs, TSOAs.
A lot of alphabet soup.
A ton of acronyms. Yeah. But to truly understand the sheer bureaucratic friction of this system, we need to examine how a company actually navigates this maze in the real world.
Yes, this is my favorite part of the source material.
Mine too. The source article provides a phenomenal, highly detailed case study that illustrates the corporate gymnastics required to secure aftermarket dominance.
The parts go scenario. It is a brilliant illustration of how intellectual property becomes the primary currency in aviation regulation.
Let's walk through the timeline of this case study for everyone listening. We start with phase one. We have an American manufacturing company, and we'll just call them PartsGo.
Okay, PartsGo.
They are highly specialized. They design and produce complex widgets. They produce them exclusively for Airbus. They have an exclusive supply contract.
Right, so they don't sell to Boeing. They don't sell directly to the airlines like Delta or United.
Exactly. Every single widget they make goes straight from their factory in the U.S. to an Airbus assembly line in Europe.
Because of that exclusive direct-to-manufacturer relationship, PartsGo is operating solely under the umbrella of the Airbus European Production Organization Authorization, the POA.
Right. And as we've already established, what is the paperwork result of operating under a European POA?
Zero FAA 833-3 tags.
None at all.
Nope. PartsGo manufactures the widget in the U.S., shifts to Europe, and when it clears the Airbus quality assurance system over there, Airbus might issue the European ESA Form 1.
But PartsGo, sitting in America, has no independent authority to issue an American airworthiness tag.
Exactly. They are entirely dependent on Airbus's regulatory umbrella.
Which, you know, is a perfectly fine business model until PartsGo realizes they are leaving millions of dollars on the table.
Always comes down to the aftermarket.
Always. They see airlines constantly needing to replace these widgets after 5 or 10 years of flying. If PartsGo could sell directly to the airlines, they could capture massive aftermarket revenue.
Oh, absolutely. The margins in the aftermarket are huge.
Right. But Delta and United, they want parts with FAA 8133 tags to keep their inventory systems streamlined and legal under FAA rules.
Exactly. They don't want the headache of the European paperwork if they can avoid it.
Yeah.
So PartsGo enters phase two.
Right. Phase two, PartsGo decides they need their own independent regulatory power. They need an FAA PMA.
And this is where the maze really begins, because Parsco is facing two potential pathways to get this PMA.
Okay, what's pathway number one?
Pathway number one is basically the brute force approach. They can submit a massive application to the FAA, relying entirely on their own independent engineering data.
So they have to prove the part is safe from scratch.
Yes. They have to prove from scratch that their widget meets every single safety tolerance required for flight on that Airbus.
Yeah.
We call that the test and computation method.
That sounds expensive.
It is punishing. It requires millions of dollars in destructive testing, flight testing, computational fluid dynamics, stress analysis.
And it probably takes forever, too.
Oh, yeah. It could take years to get the FAA to approve all that raw data.
So Parsco obviously looks for a shortcut, pathway number two.
Exactly. They decide to apply for the PMA using something the industry calls a PMA assist letter from Airbus.
A PMA assist letter.
Right. Essentially, they are seeking a licensing agreement. And this is where the intellectual property dance gets incredibly counterintuitive.
This part of the article blew my mind.
It does seem completely backward to anyone outside the industry. The article explains that Parsco, remember the company that actually engineered and invented the widget?
Right.
Parsco transfers the intellectual property rights of that design to Airbus, the type certificate holder.
Wait. I have to stop you there.
I know. It sounds crazy.
Why on earth would an American engineering firm spend millions in R&D to invent a cutting-edge component only to legally surrender the IP to the massive European conglomerate they are supplying?
Because in the heavily regulated world of aerospace, raw engineering data is essentially worthless until a civil aviation authority blesses it.
Oh.
Yeah. When Parsco transfers the IP to Airbus, Airbus integrates that widget into the overarching design of the entire A320 aircraft.
Right. It becomes part of the whole machine.
And Airbus takes that integrated data to EASA and the FAA, and the regulators approve the whole aircraft.
Yeah.
Through that process, Parsco's raw data magically transforms into legally approved data.
Ah, okay. I get it. It's like getting a security clearance.
Heavy.
Well, Parsco can't get themselves cleared quickly, right? It takes years. So they give their blueprints to a general Airbus who already has top secret clearance.
And the general gets the blueprints stamped. That's a really great way to look at it. And then here's the twist. As part of the massive supply contract they negotiated, Airbus turns around and licenses that newly stamped, officially approved data back to Parsco.
So Parsco is literally licensing their own invention back from Airbus.
Yes, but they are licensing the regulatory approval of the invention. Not the invention itself, but the stamp.
And this is the crucial shortcut.
Exactly. When Parsco goes to the FAA to apply for their PMA, they don't have to spend 3 years doing test and computation.
They just hand the FAA the licensing agreement.
Right. They hand over the assist letter and say, look, we are using data that is identical to the approved data Airbus already holds under their type certificate.
It's basically an API key for regulatory compliance. They just ping the Airbus database to instantly verify to the FAA that the part is safe.
Exactly. The FAA reviews the assist letter, confirms the identicality, and fast-tracks the approval.
So Parsco gets their FAA PMA in a fraction of the time and at a fraction of the cost.
Exactly.
And the payoff for Parsco is massive, because once the FAA officially grants that PMA, everything shifts.
Everything shifts. Parsco now holds an independent FAA production approval.
Which means when the exact same widget rolls off the exact same assembly line in their American factory,
Parsco is now legally authorized to issue an FAA Form 8133 for that new part, signed proudly on the left side.
And they can bypass Airbus entirely and sell directly into the global aftermarket, raking in the cash.
Exactly.
But the source text points out a fascinating irony here regarding Airbus.
Yes, the ultimate irony.
While Parsco is printing money shipping these new widgets with shiny American 8133 adder tags, Airbus cannot do the same.
That is the ultimate proof of how disconnected the physical object is from its legal status. The text explicitly states that Airbus, despite owning the overarching type certificate for the aircraft,
the general with the top secret clearance.
Right. Airbus has no independent authority to issue an 8133 tag for that new Parsco widget.
Because Airbus still operates under the European POA.
Correct. If the widget goes down Parsco's aftermarket supply chain, it gets an FAA 8133.
But if the exact same physical widget goes down, Airbus's supply chain to be installed on a new aircraft in Toulouse.
Airbus can only issue the ESO Form 1.
The paperwork literally dictates two entirely separate legal realities for the exact same physical piece of titanium. It's just staggering.
That really is a fascinating legal fiction.
Now, up to this point in the deep dive, we have been exclusively focused on the birth of components. The left side of the form.
Right, the origin story.
The strict, unforgiving rules governing the creation of brand new parts under Part 21 regulations. But aviation is an industry built on longevity.
Oh, absolutely. Aircraft fly for 30 years, sometimes more.
Right. Parts degrade, they break, they require overhaul. So what happens when a part loses its new status? How does the industry legally resurrect a component?
That requires a complete shift in regulatory framework. We move away from the production rules of Part 21, and we enter the maintenance rules.
Maintenance rules. Where do we find those?
Those are defined in 14 CFR Part 43. And visually, on the 80133 document itself, the signature physically moves to the opposite side of the page.
The right side signature.
Yes, the right side.
Now, the source issues a very specific warning here, urging industry professionals not to conflate the two sides.
It is a critical error to mix them up.
The text states that when the 8133 is utilized as an approval for return to service following maintenance, repair, or overhaul, the authorized signature must reside in blocks 14A through 14E on the right side of the form.
Which is brilliant. Human factors engineering, if you think about it.
How so?
Well, picture a mechanic working a night shift. It's 3 a.m., they are tired, they are pulling a component from the storeroom to get a plane ready for a 6 a.m. departure.
Right, they don't have time to read fine print.
Exactly, they don't have to read pages of dense legal text, they just glance at the form.
Oh, I see.
If the ink is on the left, it's a virgin part, fresh from the production approval holder, never been flown.
But if the ink is on the right?
If the ink is on the right, it is a veteran part. It has seen service, it is degraded, and it has been formally resurrected by an approved repair station.
It communicates the entire life cycle of the component in a fraction of a second just by the geography of the ink.
Exactly.
But let's get into the actual mechanics of that right side signature, because earlier we established that a pure European-born Airbus Part 1 that only ever had an ESO Form 1 could never, ever get an American 8133 new part tag on the left side.
That boundary is absolute. No new tags for European parts without a PMA or TSOA.
Right. But the aftermarket operates under a more pragmatic set of rules, doesn't it?
It has to. Otherwise, the global fleet would grind to a halt. The right side of the form is where the Airbus anomaly finally gets resolved.
Okay, let's walk through that scenario for the listeners. Imagine an Airbus A350. It was built in Europe with EASA-certified parts.
Okay.
It lands in Chicago. One of its hydraulic pumps fails. The airline removes the pump and sends it to an independent FAA-approved Part 145 repair station located in the United States.
Right, U.S. repair station.
What happens next?
That repair station takes the pump apart. They strip it down to its component pieces on the bench.
Okay.
They perform extensive non-destructive testing, magnetic particle inspection, fluorescent penetrant inspection. They are looking for microscopic cracks.
The trauma we talked about earlier.
Exactly. They replace the worn seals. They rebuild the pump to the exact specifications outlined in the manufacturer's overhaul manual.
Right.
And then they test it on a hydraulic rig to ensure it meets original performance parameters.
So they have physically resurrected the part. It is now safe for operation. How do they legally document that resurrection?
Because they are an FAA-approved Part 145 repair station, they are authorized under Part 43 maintenance regulations to document their overhaul work using an FAA Form 8133.
Wait, even though it is fundamentally a European Airbus part,
yes.
A part that started its life with an EA SAG.
Yes, but, and this is the critical distinction, they must sign the form on the right side.
Ah, the right side.
Yes. They are not claiming they manufactured a new part under a Part 21 production approval. That would be illegal.
Right, they didn't make the pump, they just fixed it.
Exactly. They are using the form exclusively as an approval for return to service.
That is the essential legal bridge. If we zoom out and look at the entire ecosystem we've mapped today, the dichotomy is just beautiful.
It really is.
The left side of the form represents origin, birth. It is defined by incredibly strict, almost nationalist jurisdictional boundaries. You must hold an American production approval or you cannot sign the left side.
European parts need not apply unless they execute those complex PMA or TSOA workarounds we discussed.
Right. But the right side of the form represents maintenance, resurrection. And here, the rigid jurisdictional lines are allowed to blur just enough to keep global commerce functioning.
The FAA allows its certified repair stations to touch foreign-born parts, overhaul them to strict safety standards, and legally return them to the skies using an American document.
It is a delicate, highly engineered balance between absolute safety and logistical reality. I mean, the next time you walk down a jet bridge, listener, look out the window at the aircraft. Look at the thousands of exposed rivets, the massive fan blades in the engines, the complex geometry of the landing gear.
There are millions of parts on those planes.
Millions. And every single millimeter of that machine is legally tethered to this invisible mountain of split signature paperwork. The left side berths and the right side resurrections.
It is an overwhelming administrative achievement. It ensures that the aircraft isn't just mechanically sound, but historically undeniable.
Historically undeniable. I love that phrasing. It really is the unseen infrastructure of global aviation.
Without the paper, the metal is grounded.
Okay, let's quickly recap this incredibly dense journey because we've covered a ton of ground today.
We really have.
We started with the paradox of the grounded plane, exploring how the definition of airworthiness shifted over 30 years from a purely physical inspection to an uncompromising demand for historical documentation.
Right, the whole cryptographic hash concept of the unbroken chain of custody.
Exactly. Then we dissected the left side of the FAA form 8133, explaining how it serves as a legally binding birth certificate for new parts produced under Part 21 FAA production approvals.
And we confronted the Airbus anomaly, highlighting the jurisdictional friction that prevents European parts from acquiring American origin tags.
And how that forces airlines to segregate their global inventory into parallel streams.
Then we explore the regulatory bridges, the FAA, PMA, and TSOA, that allow American manufacturers to build for European aircraft, provided they can prove compliance.
We broke down the PartsGo case study, analyzing the totally counterintuitive intellectual property licensing dance required to fast-track regulatory approval.
Licensing your own invention to get the stamp.
Right. And finally, we looked at the right side of the form, where Part 43 maintenance regulations allow approved repair stations to breathe new legal life into old foreign-born parts.
It is an intricate, analog masterpiece of regulation. It really is.
It is. But looking at the broader context of the aviation industry, it raises a compelling question about the future, doesn't it?
It does. The publication that provided our source material today frequently covers the massive strains on the current supply chain.
Oh, the bottlenecks are everywhere.
Right. We are seeing unprecedented bottlenecks in global shipping, and massive emerging markets, like China, are beginning to aggressively reshape the demand for used parts.
The volume of transactions is scaling exponentially.
Exactly. Millions of parts moving daily. And we have just spent an hour dissecting the meticulous nuances of what is fundamentally a paper-based paradigm.
Physical tags, ink signatures, literally cardboard boxes traveling with documents and plastic sleeves.
Exactly. Given the sheer complexity we discussed today, the missing tags causing costly AOG delays, the split jurisdiction inventory nightmares, the intensive IP licensing paperwork we have to ask. How much longer can this analog system hold up under the weight of a hyper-connected global economy?
You're suggesting the friction is becoming unsustainable.
I'm suggesting the friction might actually be the catalyst for change. Could the exhausting complexity of the 8133 left side, right side dance be the exact pressure point that forces the aviation industry into a fully digital paradigm?
A digital paradigm, like moving away from paper completely.
Yes. Imagine a future where the physical form is entirely obsolete. Instead, every single component is minted as a digital twin on an immutable blockchain.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. So when PartsGo transfers IP to Airbus, it's not a paper contract. An automated smart contract execution.
And when a Part 145 repair station overhauls a pump in Chicago,
they don't sign a piece of paper. They append a cryptographic block to the parts ledger, permanently linking the NDT ultrasound data directly to the part's digital identity.
So it's a completely frictionless, unalterable chain of custody from the forge to the scrap heap. Anyone, anywhere in the world could verify it instantly.
Exactly. If the paperwork is truly more important than the part, as the old joke goes, the ultimate evolution is for the paperwork to become an inseparable digital layer of the part itself.
It's a fascinating concept, the digital ghost part becoming a digital twin.
Something to ponder.
It is definitely something for you to ponder the next time you're sitting at the gate, waiting for that one final maintenance log to clear before pushback. Until next time, thanks for joining us on this deep dive.